Dear Heavenly Father, we come now to your word, and what a wonderful word this is. Lord, strengthen us, strengthen our faith, convict us, humble us, do what you will in us. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. We're going to dive right in this morning. Your handout's a little longer because we are actually covering 37 verses, all of chapter 4. And so I put it all in your handout. That made it longer. And then it is 37 verses. So we're just going to dive in. No introduction. Daniel chapter 4, verse 1. King Nebuchadnezzar, to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth. In chapter 1, we saw King Nebuchadnezzar besieging the city of Jerusalem and then carrying off its people into exile. In chapter 2, we saw King Nebuchadnezzar angry and very furious and commanding that all the wise men of Babylon be destroyed. These were his words. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you shall be turned into limbs, torn limb from limb, and your houses shall be laid in ruins. Chapter 3, we saw King Nebuchadnezzar issue a decree that all peoples, nations, languages must fall down and worship the golden image he set up, or else what? Be cast into a burning fiery furnace. So when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refused to obey, he was filled with fury. The expression of his face was changed. It's like he didn't have control over his face anymore. He was so filled with fury. And he ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated, ultimately killed his own men, and ordered that these 3 men be cast into the furnace. At the end of chapter 3, after God delivered Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego from the burning fiery furnace, the king issues another decree. And on the one hand, it's kind of good news. On the other hand, you see what the king is like. Any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses laid in ruins. Are you getting the picture? Nebuchadnezzar is a ruthless king with apparently unlimited power and unlimited freedom to do what he wants to do. Combine those two, and you've got makings of a tyrant. So when chapter 4 begins with these words, let me read them again. King Nebuchadnezzar, to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, I think we have really good reason to brace ourselves for what comes next. Don't you think? Verses 1 to 3. King Nebuchadnezzar, to all peoples, nations, languages that dwell on all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. It has seemed good to me to show the signs and wonders that the Most High God has done for me. How great are his signs, how mighty his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion endures from generation to generation. Now, we're familiar enough with Daniel that sometimes we just don't get it. Okay? I don't have any words for that. Nothing to this point in Daniel could have prepared us for that. I mean, I think sometimes we just give Nebuchadnezzar all this benefit of the doubt. Nebuchadnezzar was a pretty nice guy. I kind of like him. Well, I know Daniel got along with him, and he was concerned for him. But, I mean, Nebuchadnezzar, look what we just saw. Okay, so where did this come from? It is unexpected, and to this point at least, it's completely unexplainable. There's no explanation for this. And that is actually the point. It's the shock in your handout. It is the shock of this that prepares us to see what's the main message of this chapter. Okay, so you got to get the shock to get the point in the end. This is the pagan king Nebuchadnezzar who rules over all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth. Okay, so we've got that. And yet, the kingdom or the rule that Nebuchadnezzar talks about here is the kingdom of the Most High God, whose kingdom, he says, is everlasting and whose dominion endures from generation to generation. So, in your handouts, what we have here, what's going on, is we have two kings, two sovereignties. On the one hand, there's the pagan king, Nebuchadnezzar. And, I mean, this is a pretty big deal. He's ruling over, he is, all the nations, peoples, languages that dwell in all the earth. And then, on the other hand, there's the Most High God. Do we feel that there is a what here? Attention. Now, as I mentioned in Sunday school, and someone pointed this out to me recently, I use that word tension a lot. And I was thinking last week about why, Timothy, do you use that word so much? And whether I use it too much. I won't comment on whether I use it too much, but the tensions that we often feel, or perhaps should be feeling. I find that when I come to the scriptures, I often feel tensions. So why is that? Well, it's always the result of one or both of the following. One, the infinite, you bandy words about sometimes, but infinite truly, transcendent nature of God and his hidden wisdom. That causes me a lot of tension. So, you know, in a lot of levels, but you could start with the Trinity. If you think about it, that's tension. The incarnation, tension. The sovereignty of God and the responsibility of man, tension. Okay. But then there's another aspect, isn't there? It's not just the infinite transcendence of God. It's my own fallen, sinful condition as a finite human being. It's as a result of who God is as the creator and then who we are here as the creatures, not just as creatures, but as fallen and sinful creatures. That only makes it worse. It's not like if we weren't fallen, we'd get it and no more tensions, right? But that only adds to it. We very often feel tensions when we come to the scriptures honestly. Honestly. So, whenever I use the word tension, what lies back of that word for me is the holy supremacy of God in contrast to my creaturely limitations. And so once again, let me ask, in light of that, do you feel the tension? Between these two sovereignties, okay, we've got the rule of King Nebuchadnezzar and the rule of the Most High God. The Most High. That's a word or a phrase that appears 6 times just in this chapter. So you can watch for it as we go through. 6 times. 14 times just in chapters 3 to 7 of Daniel. So it gives us a major clue as to the theme of the chapter and the theme of Daniel as a whole, the Most High. It means exactly what it sounds like it means. If I asked you, what does the Most High mean? Well, that's one of those things that's kind of easy to define, right? It means Most High. I know you're not supposed to define words with the words themselves, but I think that's what you can do in this case. The Most High, the one who has no rival, the one who is supreme over all. So, what does that mean? Okay, in the Psalms, that supremacy of God. And well, it's revealed not just in his power. I think when we think of being Most High, we think of the one who's powerful. But the Most High is also revealed in his saving righteousness. That's what shows that he's Most High. His steadfast covenant love reveals that he is Most High. His infinite, perfect wisdom reveals that he is Most High. So don't reduce God to just the Most High in his power, but in his love and his salvation and his wisdom. In the Psalms, actually the Most Highness, if I could use that expression of God, means especially that his rule and sovereignty doesn't have any boundaries. If he's Most High, there are no limits, no boundaries, but encompasses the whole earth. So Genesis 14, Melchizedek blessed Abram and said, "Blessed be Abram by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth." Psalm 47, "For the Lord, the Most High, is to be feared, a great king, over how much of the earth?" All the earth, all of it. Psalm 83, "You alone, whose name is the Lord, are the Most High over all the earth." See how that is put together. And that's wonderful sounding, and we love that. But how does it work out in practice? Okay, who do we see? And we can't be pat here. Because if we don't feel the tension, there's some people living in places of the world who can feel it easier than you and I can. Who do we see ruling the world and apparently doing just as they please? We see human presidents, human prime ministers, human senators, congressmen, human dictators and tyrants, whatever form of human government. At certain times in history, we see human Nebuchadnezzars who can legitimately write to all peoples, nations, languages that dwell in all the earth under my rule. I don't think it takes a whole lot of honesty to feel that there's a tension here. And even at times, an irreconcilable contradiction. I'm not using that word just to try to get us all worked up. I'm using that word because I think when we're honest, we can feel that. An irreconcilable contradiction between the claims of God's sovereignty as the Most High over all the earth and the claims of human sovereigns like King Nebuchadnezzar, and that's especially true when God's people find themselves living in where? In exile. In Babylon. So let's put it like this. Simply, how can there be the Most High God who has no rival, who's over all the earth, and at the same time a King Nebuchadnezzar? How can that be? Maybe we admit, maybe I could see that if all the kings of the earth were always talking like Nebuchadnezzar does here. I could see that. But they're not, are they? In fact, they rarely ever do. But what does Nebuchadnezzar confess here? That God's kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. Not just when people are confessing it, it's always, and his dominion endures from generation to generation. But if what I see around me and on the news is actual reality, if the experience of God's people in exile is real, how can that be? How do we resolve this difficult tension? Nebuchadnezzar writes, "It has seemed good to me to show the signs and wonders that the Most High God has done for me. How great are his signs, how mighty his wonders." Wonders refers to, you know, it's called signs and wonders. Well, it's the same thing, but on one side of that thing, it's a wonder. On the other side, it's a sign. And what are those two things? A wonder refers to the awe-inspiring, in your handout, supernatural character of God's works. So it's a wonder. On the other hand, we have the signs, because God's wonders never are for their own sake, just to amaze us. God's wonders are meant to point us to something. So they're signs, pointing beyond themselves to something we're meant to understand. Maybe you could think of it like this. I think this is in your handout. As signs, you could say they always signify. Do you see the word sign and signify? So a sign signifies something. It's intended to communicate something deeper to us and ultimately to teach us, remember the theme of Daniel, wisdom. Wisdom. How great are his signs, how mighty his wonders. So there's where we're to look for the resolution of the tension. If you want to know how to resolve the tension, it's in the signs and the wonders that we're about to have related to us. We go on to read verses 4 to 7. "I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at ease in my house and prospering in my palace. I saw a dream that made me afraid. As I lay in bed, the fancies and the visions of my head alarmed me. So I made a decree that all the wise men of Babylon should be brought before me, that they might make known to me the interpretation of the dream. Then the magicians, the enchanters, the Chaldeans, and the astrologers came in, and I told them the dream, but they could not make known to me the interpretation. So back in the other dream Nebuchadnezzar had, which was maybe 20 years earlier, okay, so a lot of time has passed, his spirit was troubled, it says, and his sleep left him. But this time, even at the height of his power, it says that the king is afraid, but the word has more the idea of terrified. The king is terrified and alarmed. So he calls in his magicians, enchanters, Chaldeans, and astrologers, all his experts, he calls them in. And even though this time he tells them what the dream was, remember last time he wouldn't tell them the dream, this time he does, they still can't tell the dream its interpretation. Now we might wonder why that is. I have some guesses. I wonder if part of the, you know, because what were they doing with all of his other dreams? They told him those meanings even though they didn't know what they were talking about. So why couldn't they do that here? I wonder if part of the reason is that they didn't dare to confirm the part of the meaning that was already very obvious. I mean, if they tried to get around the clear meaning of the dream, the king's going to be like, you guys don't know what you're talking about, do you? It was actually very clear. I wonder if another part of the reason was that usually the Chaldeans, if the king had a dream that sounded like it was going to go bad for him, the Chaldeans had these formulas and these prescriptions to undo the bad meaning of the dream. Well, if you do this, it kind of all works itself out. But this dream, I wonder, maybe they thought they didn't have any prescriptions that really could undo that kind of a dream. It was so explicit, so clear. Whatever the case, the stage is set, and that's the point. Sometimes we get bogged down in, well, why couldn't they tell the dream? When in reality, we're just supposed to be saying, the stage is set. Where's Daniel? Right? It's time for Daniel. And so we read in verses 8 to 9, At last Daniel came in before me, he who was named Belteshazzar after the name of my God, and in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. And I told him the dream, saying, O Belteshazzar, chief of the magicians, because I know that the spirit of the holy gods is in you, and that no mystery is too difficult for you, tell me the visions of my dream that I saw, and their interpretation. We might also wonder, sometimes we're like, well, why wasn't Daniel brought in at the beginning? Isn't he the one you go to first? Well, maybe it was protocol. You don't bring in the head honcho first. He's for last resort. You bring in the regulars first. Maybe Daniel couldn't be summoned as quickly. Maybe he was a little further out. Maybe he was busy with something in the middle. I don't know. He couldn't make it to the palace as quickly as the others. Or maybe Nebuchadnezzar hoped that his regular wise men would be more likely to give him somehow a favorable interpretation of this really terrifying dream. I don't know why Daniel didn't come in first. But once again, what's the point? The stage is being set. All right. And even in the way the story's told, and some have suggested, and this made a lot of sense to me, that Daniel might have had a big hand in helping the king compose this letter. Who better to help? You know, presidents don't write their own speeches, generally, do they? No. Now, certainly they have to approve them. So I wonder if at some level Daniel was the letter writer here, writing what the king said, but writing it appropriately. And so we see, even the way the story is told, that we're all being drawn in to see not just what the dream is. That's not what you want to know, is it? You want to know what the dream is, but you want to know what its meaning will be. Because we still don't know either. Verses 10 to 12. The visions of my head as I lay in bed were these. I saw and behold a tree in the midst of the earth, and its height was great. The tree grew and became strong, and its top reached to heaven. And it was visible to the end of the whole earth. Its leaves were beautiful and its fruit abundant, and in it was food for all. The beasts of the field found shade under it, and the birds of the heavens lived in its branches, and all flesh was fed from it. So we see a tree, okay? You have a picture of this? There's a tree growing, and where is it growing? In the midst of the earth. What does that mean? It means at the center of the earth. The point isn't that the earth actually has a center. The point is that the tree is situated so that everything else revolves around this tree. This is it. The tree grows, and its top reaches to heaven. This is quite a picture. And not only that, but it provides food and shade for all the beasts of the field. It's like this cosmic, universal tree. But this was an image that Nebuchadnezzar would have been very familiar with. I was putting it this way to my family this morning. It's not like God said, well, let me think about an analogy I can use. Oh, let's do a tree, right? And I know that God does never thinks like that. But this was an image already known to the people. Nebuchadnezzar knew this image. It was famous. It was common. It was really part of the pagan myths of Nebuchadnezzar's day. Myths that they would invent a myth to help explain what they saw. Okay, this is what we see, so let's invent a myth that it kind of explains it, gives meaning to it. So we can read this. Someone says this, a lofty, verdant, sap, full of sap and life, tree, like this, is a common symbol for the living, transcendent, life-giving, sustaining cosmos, or reality. I know it's all weird sounding. Or the deity itself. A sacred tree at the center of the earth symbolically links earth, the dwelling of man, and heaven, the dwelling of the gods. Okay, you're seeing this picture. Very pagan. Sometimes the king then takes the place of the tree in the imagery, iconography, in the pictures. In such scenes, the king is portrayed as the human personification of the tree. So now the king stands in for the tree. Thus, if the tree symbolized the divine world order, then the king himself represented the realization of that order in man. In other words, a true image of God, the perfect man. Now, can you see that there's a little bit of truth in that? There's an element of truth in this pagan myth. What do we read in Genesis 1? So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the heavens, over every living thing that moves on the earth. So what we have here is man as the image of God. Okay, we're not the beasts. We're the image of God. Was to bring God's life-giving rule, think of the tree, God's life-giving rule to the world as royal kings and queens. And the image of a life-giving tree is a wonderful way of picturing this. It's a beautiful picture. At least not in its pagan form. But within this pagan myth, we have truth, we have real beauty. So you can see the real beauty of it. And yet, the truth and the beauty has been perverted and twisted. Do you see how that is? In the Bible, the Creator is never reduced to the level of his creation. And how was the Creator reduced to the level of creation in the pagan myth? It's pictured as a what? A tree, a sacred tree. We know we cannot do that in the Scriptures. He can never be represented in pictures as a sacred, life-giving tree. In the Bible, even though man is the image of God, yes, and so in that sense, the king represents God in that tree imagery, but man is not the personification of God. Man could never stand in for God. Okay, God, step aside for a minute, and I'll stand in for you. Let me take the place of the tree. So do you see in this mythic imagery, which we're not trying to be fancy, but this is stuff that Nebuchadnezzar knew, Daniel knew, the people knew. So if we want to get this, we have to need to enter into that a little. So in this mythic imagery of the tree, you can see how the lines are blurred. between the Creator and the creature. On the one hand, the gods are brought down to the level of the creation. On the other hand, man is elevated to the level of the gods. And isn't that the very thing we see in Genesis when the serpent tempted Eve with the promise of being like God? This is the fundamental problem, the blurring of the line between the Creator and the creature. Ever since the fall, this is important right here. Ever since the fall, the rule and the kingship that God gave to man has been pursued in rebellion against the rule and the kingship of God. Tension. And that's what we see here in this image of the tree with its top that reached to where? To heaven. Yeah, you have to ask yourself, was it just aspiring to reach to heaven, or did it actually reach to heaven? Well, remember the Tower of Babel in Genesis 11? The people said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, the realm of the gods. Let's reach all the way to there. Ezekiel 31, we read of another tree. Behold, Assyria was a cedar in Lebanon with beautiful branches and forest shade, and of towering height, its top among the clouds. So it towered high above all the trees of the field. All the birds of the heavens made their nests in its boughs. See how this imagery is used elsewhere? Because it's commonplace imagery. Under its branches, all the beasts of the field gave birth to the young, and under its shadow lived all great nations. It towered high and set its top among the clouds, and its heart was proud of its height. Nebuchadnezzar adds that it was visible to the end of the whole earth, symbolizing its rule over all the earth. So, Nebuchadnezzar, he sees this first part of the dream, and do you think he gets it? Yeah, he gets it. And I think he's quite satisfied with his dream so far. He's probably enjoying this dream. This is a good dream. Because he already saw himself as the personification of this life-giving, life-sustaining tree, exalted to the heavens, visible to the end of the earth. Remember, there's much about that that's beautiful. Remember, God did give to man as his image-bearer the privilege of ruling and giving life through that rule. The problem in your handout is this tree has exalted its own rule and sovereignty in a bid to take the place of God. And there's another problem. And this is really, really important. The first one is vertical. He's exalted his sovereignty in a bid to take the place of God. So it's an assault on God. But then there's another problem. Whenever you arrogantly exalt yourself like this, it inevitably results in taking the power that you've been given to sustain and protect life and twisting it as a means to oppress and destroy life. That's the vertical of the horizontal. Okay, so we had the vertical, but there's also the horizontal. And so we see Nebuchadnezzar's approach to life in the first three chapters. Do you see again then the tension? I'll ask it this like this. Is it coming into focus for you in high definition? How can there be the Most High God? If we can't ask this, we don't really get the world, do we? How can there be the Most High God who has no rival? Who is truly over all the earth and at the same time a King Nebuchadnezzar? Can very much feel like an irreconcilable contradiction, especially for those of us still living in exile. But here's the thing, if we can't somehow resolve this tension, how can we be equipped? And I really mean this, because as I prepared this sermon, I realized some people, maybe who don't have faith, would laugh at me. Like, yeah, you've got all you need, your house, your cars, your clothes, your friends, everything you need, and you can sit here and talk about all this. But if we can't resolve this tension, how are you going to be equipped to stay faithful in those times when it seems to you and to me that the sovereignty of man has totally and completely usurped the sovereignty of God? That was very much the question for the exiles in Daniel's day. Daniel didn't just think, I think this is a good point to make today. No, it was the question that they were asking and needed answering. And it's the question that remains important for us. In Nebuchadnezzar's pagan worldview, the tree was inviolate. And I was going to look up how to say that. I think I'm saying that right. It means, you know, you can't touch the tree. The tree was the sacred tree. You can imagine then the reason for his terror. And I never really got it before this. I always thought, oh, they chopped down the tree. Big deal. Well, now I see what the big deal is, okay? So in light of what that tree is, what it pictures, the imagery behind it, now read, I saw in the visions of my head as I lay in bed, and behold, a watcher, a holy one, came down from heaven. He proclaimed aloud and said thus, chop down the tree. Lop off its branches, strip off its leaves, scatter its fruit, let the beasts flee from under it, the birds from its branches, but leave the stump of its roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze. We're not going to talk about that because there's two things it could mean, maybe three, and I don't really know. And Daniel never talks about it more. So you can guess too. We go on amid the tender grass of the field, leave the stump, and now the imagery changes to a man. Let him be wet with the dew of heaven. Let his portion be with the beasts in the grass of the earth. Let his mind be changed from a man's, and let a beast's mind be given to him. Are you seeing something profound about that? And let seven periods of time pass over him. The sentence is by the decree of the watchers, the decision by the word of the holy ones, to the end that the living may know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will and sets over it the lowliest of men. Okay, you can tell where we're going. That's the main point. But before that, you can see how shocking and horrifying this imagery is. Think about it. The tree, hacked, chopped, lopped, stripped, scattered. Let's put it in perspective. It was to man, and what sets man apart? He is the image bearer of God. It was to man as his image bearer that God gave the responsibility of mediating his life-giving rule to creation. Psalm 8. What is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you care for him? Yet you have made him a little lower than the heavenly beings and crowned him. There's that rule and dominion, that sovereignty, in a sense, crowned him with glory and honor. You have given him dominion over the works of your hands. You put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, and also what? What under his feet? The beasts of the field. What do we see here? God dethrones man. How? By decreeing that man, who was created as the image of God, be given the mind of a beast. How great his signs. How mighty his wonders. And so the evidences of God's unrivaled sovereignty are everywhere in these verses. I just want to highlight two. First, notice the sentence is by the decree of the watchers. That's an unusual phrase. It's not used, I think it's only used here in the entire Bible. But the picture of the watcher is someone who's never sleeping, always watching, always vigilant. Okay? So these are the unsleeping, constantly vigilant servants of God. You think of it says of God, he never slumbers or sleeps. And then the decision is by the word of the holy ones. That means the supernatural heavenly beings. Now, here's the thing. Look at this. Who actually made the decree? Who actually decreed this? Well, God did. But in being proclaimed and carried out by the watchers and the holy ones, what we have being pictured for us is how this sovereign rule of God, I mean, we know that God is everywhere, right? He's omnipresent. So he can rule over the whole world without watchers and holy ones. But how does he communicate his sovereign rule over the whole world to us? He shows how he enacts his rule and carries it out through servants that he sends out into all the world. And so we see that pictured for us. Think of when the Lord was standing above a stairway on which his angels were ascending and descending. That pictured his sovereignty over the whole world. Or think about in Zechariah when God sent his angels and the chariots out to patrol the earth into all the four corners of the earth. His sovereignty over the whole world. That's what it's picturing. And so here, the watchers and the holy ones, sovereignty over the whole earth. It's pictured. Notice too how Nebuchadnezzar saw a watcher, a holy one, who, what was the directional here? Who came down from heaven. Now, what was this tree doing? It was at a top that reached to heaven. We're reminded again of the Tower of Babel in Genesis 11. The Lord, remember they said, let's build a tower with its top that'll reach to heaven? Well, then it says, and the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of man had built. We asked earlier, how can God really be the Most High over all the earth if what we see around us and take a good hard look, a really good hard look, if what we see around us is actual reality? And the answer is this, that while this is reality, it's not some figment of our imaginations, it actually is happening and it's real, it always must be interpreted in the light of a greater reality. One that almost always remains invisible. You see, in the Bible, there are times when the hidden reality breaks out and we see it with these eyes. But those are momentary times. One such time is here. The command to chop down the tree is followed by this qualification. And how many of you does this kind of bother you at first? But leave the stump of its roots in the earth. After all the hacking and chopping and lopping and scattering and all of that, this looks like a job unfinished to me. Leaving the stump and its roots in the earth, and let 7 periods of time pass over him. What is that about? So what happens after these 7 periods of time have passed? Is the stump going to bud and put out branches and grow again into a lofty, life-sustaining tree in the midst of the earth? How can that be? How can that be? Why would God do that? And the answer is in these words. The sentence is by the decree of the watchers, the decision by the word of the holy ones, to the end that the living may know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will and sets over it the lowliest of men. Did you see in those words that there are still 2 sovereignties? Now, I know we might want to reserve the word technically for only God, but there are 2 sovereignties here. And did you see how they're related? How they're related? Did you see that? The Most High rules the kingdom, and the kingdom of men is a rule. He rules, so we could say, the Most High rules the rule of men. Oh, I can't believe I get to preach this. I can't believe we get to hear this. The point is not that the Most High rules the kingdom of men only when men see and admit that he does. See, that's a temptation, I think, just to subconsciously be in your head. Yeah, the Most High rules the kingdom of men, and it's really important you get that, because if you don't recognize that, he's not quite got it. No, he rules the kingdom of men whether you see it or not. whether you admit that he does or not. Whether Nebuchadnezzar admits that he does or not. Whether Kim Jong-un admits that he does or not. Whether Trump admits that he does or not. He rules. The point is that the living may know that even when they can't see it and aren't confessing it, even then the Most High rules. Because it's like, well, we love this chapter. Nebuchadnezzar gets it. Look, the Most High is ruling because Nebuchadnezzar gets it. No. No. Giving it to whom he will, setting over at the lowliest of men. In other words, it was God who willed to give the kingdom to Nebuchadnezzar. It was the Most High who purposed to set Nebuchadnezzar over the kingdom of men. And that is what we're meant to see with the eyes of faith, as we still live in exile in this fallen world. That's the wisdom that we're meant to learn. So let's go on and read now the rest of the story, verses, not the rest of it, 18 to 26. This dream I, King Nebuchadnezzar, saw, and you, O Belteshazzar, tell me the interpretation, because all the wise men of my kingdom are not able to make known to me the interpretation, but you are able, for the spirit of the holy gods is in you. Then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was dismayed for a while, and his thoughts alarmed him. The king answered and said, Belteshazzar, let not the dream or the interpretation alarm you. Belteshazzar answered and said, my lord, may the dream be for those who hate you, and its interpretation for your enemies. The tree you saw, which grew and became strong so that its top reached to heaven, and it was visible to the end of the whole earth, whose leaves were beautiful and its fruit abundant, and in which was food for all, under which beasts of the field found shade, and whose branches the birds of the heavens lived. It is you, O king, who have grown and become strong. Your greatness has grown and reaches to heaven, and your dominion to the ends of the earth. And because the king saw a watcher, a holy one, coming down from heaven and saying, chop down the tree and destroy it, but leave the stump of its roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze in the tender grass of the field, and let him be wet with the dew of heaven, and let his portion be with the beasts of the field, till 7 periods of time pass over him. This is the interpretation, O king. It is a decree of the Most High, which has come upon my lord the king. You see the two sovereignties and how they're relating here. That you shall be driven from among men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. You shall be made to eat grass like an ox, and you shall be wet with the dew of heaven, and 7 periods of time. I don't believe that's necessarily 7 years or 7 months. We'll come back to that another time. But 7 periods of time shall pass over you till you know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will. And as it was commanded to leave the stump of the roots of the tree, your kingdom shall be confirmed for you. Your kingdom, see, there is his, that sovereignty, that rule, but it shall be confirmed for you from the time that you know that heaven rules. Let's be clear. Let's clarify. He did not say, from the time that you let heaven rule, but from the time that you know that heaven rules. I'm not saying that for rhetorical, just fancy effect. I mean that. That's important. It's not till you allow the Most High to rule the kingdom of men. God's got to get your attention, Nebuchadnezzar, because he's got to get back to ruling here. No. Till you know that the Most High does rule, always has, always will, the kingdom of men, and he always has, does, and always will give it to whom he will. Here again are words almost literally breathtaking in their scope and power. Here are words that, as I considered them, I believe they expose the true feebleness of our faith. So we ask, though, does this mean that God looks with favor on the king or the ruler or the president or the lawmaker? Does he look with favor on those who take their power to sustain and protect life like that tree was to do? and use it instead to oppress and destroy? Does God look with favor on Nebuchadnezzar's tearing people limb from limb just because he lost his temper? Go on to read Daniel's last words to the king in verse 27. Therefore, O king, let my counsel be acceptable to you. Break off your sins by practicing righteousness, and your iniquities by showing mercy to the oppressed. Does God care about what rulers do, the very rulers he appointed? Yes, he does. That there may perhaps be a lengthening of your prosperity. Is there a tension here? Yes, there is. We may not understand why God sometimes wills to give. Notice I did not say permits to gain. He wills to give the kingdom to oppressive rulers and tyrants. Now, we say permits sometimes, and I understand, just so we know that God doesn't will all the wicked things they do, in the sense of I love what they do. But at another level, he does will it, because his will is determinative of all, ultimately. We may not understand why God wills to give the kingdom to oppressive rulers and tyrants, any more than we understand why God sometimes wills to give the kingdom to men actively seeking to exalt themselves against himself. See, that's what I want us to see. We focus on, God made this guy the ruler, and look what he's doing to us, to God's people. He oppresses, he's cruel. We forget that when God willed to give the kingdom to that ruler and tyrant, that ruler is also exalting himself over against God and his sovereignty. It's not just about how we're affected. It's about the assault on the sovereignty of God, which is ultimately not in question. But this we can always know in the midst of this. God's revealed will is always, 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 always for the rulers he appointed to break off their sins by practicing righteousness and their iniquities by showing mercy to the oppressed. This too we can always know. Even when human rulers exalt themselves above God, even when they use their power to oppress and destroy, even to oppress and destroy God's people, it is still, even then, the Most High. What does the Most High mean? The Most High, who gives the kingdom to whom he will. And sets over it whom he will. So we read in verses 28 to 33. All this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of 12 months, he was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon. And the king answered and said, and you can read in the history books all that he was seeing from his roof, "Is not this great Babylon, which I have built by my mighty power as a royal residence and for the glory of my majesty?" While the words were still in the king's mouth, 12 months had elapsed since his dream, but now it falls. There fell a voice from heaven, "O King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom has departed from you. And you shall be driven from among men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field." Remember, God doesn't always do this. He does it here to teach us wisdom. "And you shall be made to eat grass like an ox, and 7 periods of time shall pass over you until you know." Here it is for the third time, "that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will." Immediately the word was fulfilled against Nebuchadnezzar. He was driven from among men and ate grass like an ox, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven till his hair grew as long as eagle's feathers and his nails were like bird's claws. Do you see it? All right. Man, who was created in God's image and given the privilege of ruling over all the beasts of the field, now loses that privilege. And how long does it take for him to lose that privilege? A single moment. A single moment. By being, as it were, turned into a beast himself. Brothers and sisters, I would say with Nebuchadnezzar, how great are his signs. How mighty his wonders. And so we learn what? Wisdom. The last 15 verses have all been in the third person, okay? He, him, that's not how it started. Now the chapter concludes with a return to the first person. Nebuchadnezzar says, I, me. And so now the theme of the opening verses is taken up again and it's intensified. That's what's happening here. Okay, the theme of the whole chapter is gathered up and given its most powerful, most breathtaking expression in these closing verses. At the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my reason returned to me, and I blessed the Most High, and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion. His kingdom endures from generation to generation, not just when I'm admitting it. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, and he does according to his will among the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. And none can stay his hand or say to him, what have you done? At the same time, my reason returned to me, and for the glory of my kingdom, my majesty and splendor returned to me. My counselors and my lords sought me, and I was established in my kingdom, and still more greatness was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, make a decree, you should be torn limb from limb if you don't. No, that's not what he says. He says, now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of Heaven. The only time in the Old Testament he's referred to as the King of Heaven. For all his works are right, and his ways are just. And those who walk in pride, he is able to humble. Okay, as we come to conclude, I ask you this question, first of all. What is all this meant to teach us? What is the wisdom that all of these words here impart to us? We're going to come back to this next week. But I'll just say now, the point of this chapter is not, it is not this. It's not for you to put yourself in Nebuchadnezzar's shoes. And remember that if I become arrogant like Nebuchadnezzar did, God can humble me. Okay? That's not the point. And we'll talk more about that next week. It's true, isn't it? It's true. It's a legitimate lesson to learn, but it is not at all the point of this chapter. The point is for us to learn a different kind of humility. The point is not, when I get too big for my britches and I got the chips on my shoulders and I think I'm all that, God can take me down a notch or two or completely level me to the dust. He can do that. That's not the point. The point is for us to learn to humble ourselves before the God who wills to give the kingdom to Nebuchadnezzar's. Even to Hitler's, who wills to give the kingdom to Saddam Hussein's and Kim Jong-un's. The point is for us to learn to humble ourselves before that God. That's the point of this chapter. It's for us as God's people to worship before him. And I think when I actually start to contemplate and comprehend this, the first response is just, okay, worship. Humbly confessing that the Most High does according to his will. He does, doesn't he, among the host of heaven. And if he does it among the host of heaven, how much more among the inhabitants of the earth? And none can stay his hand or say to him, what have you done? Now, we know what it means there. None can say to him, what have you done? But there is a sense in which we have all, at some points, asked, what have we asked of God? What have you done? When have you asked that? Maybe we didn't even recognize we were. What have you done? The signs and wonders of the Most High in this chapter are meant to teach us a wisdom, that instead of asking, "What have you done?" humbly confesses instead, "All his works are right, and all his ways are just." And though he doesn't always do it on our timetable, or even in our lifetime, we know that those human kings and rulers who walk in pride, he is able to humble. And so we worship, and we trust, and we rejoice, and we hope. That's the kind of Christians we are in the daily living of our lives. And so far as we're able, we submit to the governing authorities because we know there's no authority except from God. Even those that, at the end of the day, we have to rebel against. Remember when you rebel, right? When we can't obey man rather than God, remember even then, it was God who placed and set that person in that position. And then we remember these verses. Thus says the Lord God, "I myself will take a sprig from the lofty top of the cedar and will set it out. I will break off from the topmost of its young twigs a tender one, and I myself will plant it on a high and lofty mountain." You imagine that mountain at the center of the earth. "On the mountain height of Israel will I plant it, that it may bear branches and produce fruit and become a noble cedar, and under it will dwell every kind of bird. In the shade of its branches, birds of every sort will nest. And all the trees of the field shall know that I am the Lord." And Jesus borrows this imagery when he speaks of the kingdom being like that mustard seed that grows into a tree where the birds nest in its branches. "I bring low the high tree, I make high the low tree, dry up the green tree and make the dry tree flourish. I am the Lord, I have spoken, and I will do it." And how did he do it? Isaiah chapter 11. "There shall come forth a shoot from the stump of Jesse, and a branch from his roots shall bear fruit. And the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might. And the rule that was given to man in Genesis 1 will be fulfilled in the rule of this man, the Son of God, the Messiah. The Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord, his delight shall be in the fear of the Lord. He shall not judge by what his eyes see or decide disputes by what his ears hear, but with righteousness he shall judge the poor and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. And he shall strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he shall kill the wicked. Righteousness shall be the belt of his waist, and faithfulness the belt of his loins." Dear Heavenly Father, thank you that you are the Most High, and that you rule the kingdom of men, giving it to whom you will, setting over it whom you will. Thank you that you are able to humble those rulers who walk in pride. And thank you that one day, thank you that already you have taken that sprig, that tender twig from the top of the cedar, and you have planted it on the height of Israel at the center of the earth, and it is even now growing to be that lofty tree under which all the peoples of the earth will find shade and shelter. In the meantime, as we live in this world of tyrants and dictators, and even those who would not be labeled that, but who still exalt themselves against you and oppress life and your people, what I pray is that we live in this, in these realities in exile, that we humble ourselves before you, O God, who has given the rule to such as these. and teach us in this humility. Worship. Trust. Peace. Obedience. Thank you, though, that as we see these rulers in the earth, by faith we see Christ seated at your right hand. The shoot from the stump of Jesse and the branch from his roots that will bear fruit. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.